make her an offer. How about I tell Lupe not to come next week since you're going to be on vacation and we just call it a day? During that same year, I was asked to speak about my homeland to a 7th grade class at my school. The girl who had asked me was a neighbor who needed some extra credit in social studies. I showed up complete with my books in Persian, a doll depicting a villager weaving a Persian rug, several Persian miniatures, and some stuffed grape leaves, courtesy of my mother. I stood in front of the class and said, "Hello, my name is Firuzeh, and I'm from Iran." Before I could say anything else, the teacher stood up and said, "Laura, you said she's from Peru!" If my life were a Hollywood musical, this would have been the beginning of the big dance number. You say tomato, I say tomato. You say Persia, I say Peru. Let's call the whole thing off. So home I went with my Persian miniatures, my doll depicting a villager weaving a Persian rug, and my books. At least my mother didn't have to cook dinner that night since the 30 grape leaves were enough for all of us. During our stay in Newport Beach, the Iranian Revolution took place, and a group of Americans were taken hostage in the American Embassy in Tehran. Overnight, Iranians living in America became, to say the least, very unpopular. For some reason, many Americans began to think that all Iranians, despite outward appearances to the contrary, could at any given moment get angry and take prisoners. People always asked us what we thought of the hostage situation. "It's awful," we always said. This reply was generally met with surprise. We were asked our opinion on the hostages so often that I started reminding people that they weren't in our garage. My mother solved the problem by claiming to be from Russia or Turkey. Sometimes I'd just say, "Have you noticed how all the recent serial killers have been Americans? I won't hold it against you." From Newport Beach, I moved to Berkeley, a town once described as the armpit of California. But Berkeley wasn't just any armpit. It was an armpit in need of a shave and a shower, an armpit full of well-read people who had not only heard of Iran, but knew something about it. In Berkeley, people were either thrilled or horrified to meet an Iranian. Reactions included, "So what do you think of the fascist American CIA pigs who supported the Shah's dictatorship, only to use him as a puppet in their endless thirst for power in the Middle East and other areas like Nicaragua?" Sometimes mentioning that I was from Iran completely ended the conversation. I never knew why, but I assume some feared that I might really be yet another female terrorist masquerading as a history of art major at UC Berkeley. My favorite category of question, however, assumed that all Iranians were really just one big family. "Do you know Ali Akbari in Cincinnati?" people would ask. "He's so nice." During my years at Berkeley, I met François, a Frenchman who later became my husband. It was during our friendship that I realized how unfair my life had truly been. Being French in America is like having your hand stamped with one of those passes that allows you to get into everything. All François has to do is mention his obviously French name, and people find him intriguing. It is assumed that he's a sensitive, well-read intellectual, someone who, when not reciting Baudelaire, spends his days creating impressionist paintings. Every American seems to have a favorite France story. "It was the loveliest café, and I can still taste the tartatin." As far as I know, François had not made that tartatin, although people are more than happy to give him credit. "You know," I always add, "France has an ugly colonial past." But it doesn't matter. People see my husband and think of Gene Kelly dancing with Leslie Caron. People see me and think of hostages. This is why, in my next life, I'm applying to come back as a Swede. I assume that as a Swede, I will be a leggy blonde. Should God get things confused and send me back as a Swede trapped in the body of a Middle Eastern woman, I'll just pretend I'm French. A dozen keychains. In my large extended family, each member has a reputation. This reputation, carved in stone, is usually the result of a somewhat random act that for some unknown reason takes on a far greater meaning and becomes the defining moment in a life. At the tender age of 5, for instance, my cousin Ardashir developed the nasty habit of defecating behind his parents' living room curtains during their frequent formal dinner parties. Today, someone might interpret this behavior as a sign of anger, since the poor tot was stuck with a nanny against his wishes while the other family members reveled. Instead, it came to serve as a reflection of the type of person he really is. having outgrown his annoying and unique routine, Adeshi went on to become a restaurant owner. Recently, at a family gathering that took place during a slow patch in his otherwise successful career, someone mentioned that Adeshi's restaurant wasn't doing too well. To this, my aunt replied, "Well, what do you expect from someone who poops behind curtains?" As much as Adeshid has suffered from his reputation, my older brother Fashid continues to thrive on his. When Fashid was in kindergarten back in Abadan, he was, according to all reports, an extremely popular and charismatic little person. This may not seem like such a big deal in other families, but my parents, both of whom are painfully shy, looked upon their outgoing anomaly just as Native Americans regard an albino buffalo. He was a miracle. 40 years after completing kindergarten, my brother is still consulted before all decisions, big or small. Fashid has steered endless number of cousins and second cousins through decisions ranging from which type of car to buy, to which courses to take in college, to which nasal decongestant works best. Nobody is more devoted to Fashid's decision-making prowess than my parents, and Fashid, like James Bond, has never turned down an assignment. When I was 11 years old, I told my parents I wanted to go to camp. The year was 1976, and I had lived in America for a total of 2 years. Except for some sleepovers back in second grade, I had never spent the night away from my parents. I cannot remember what possessed me to want to try summer camp. I'm not sure I even knew what one did at camp. But for whatever reason, I made the announcement, and my parents immediately assigned Fashid, who was then 18, the task of finding the right camp for me. After much research, Fashid found the perfect camp, Pine Lodge Mountain Summer Camp, located in the Mammoth Mountains, a mere 8-hour drive from my house. My father, whose cult-like devotion to Fashid rules out the possibility of questioning any of Fashid's decisions, was very impressed that the camp cost $500 for 2 weeks. "Anything that expensive has to be good," he repeatedly said. The Pine Lodge brochure also came with a stamp of approval from a camp organization that none of us had ever heard of, but which further impressed my father. My mother, as usual, had no comment, although 20 years later she did say, "I didn't think you should have gone." After signing up for Pine Lodge Mountain Summer Camp, I received a list of supplies I would need, none of which we owned. The following Saturday, my father and I set out for Montgomery Ward. My father, whose aversion to shopping is well known, believes that anything that costs more than it did back in Ahvaz in 1946 is overpriced. Fortunately, he is always willing to pay for classes and experiences that promote growth of some sort, but everything else is too expensive. His inability to pay full price for anything explains why he owns what is, as far as we know, the only maroon and pink suede pair of Nikes in existence. The items he has picked up on clearance tables range from merely useless, like his portable siren, to truly atrocious, like birds made of felt. And even he has admitted that people do stare at his maroon Nikes in a way that suggests something other than envy. But the magnetic pull of a bargain is simply too strong. List in hand, my father and I headed straight for the clearance section in the camping department. The first item on our list was a sleeping bag. Unfortunately for me, there happened to be one on sale. Although I knew nothing about sleeping bags, I did notice that this one was considerably larger and bulkier than the ones not on sale. While the others rolled up and fit neatly into small drawstring bags, this one was the size of our kitchen table, which my father had bought at an auction of seized goods. I did point out to my father that this particular sleeping bag did not come with a drawstring bag. My father assured me that he would find some kind of bag at home. After all, you'd have to be stupid to pass up a sleeping bag that cost only $8.99. We continued down the list and purchased the cheapest version of everything, skipping the optional items entirely. Those, my father explained, were for people who just like to buy stuff. Inflatable mattress, wide-brimmed hat, insect repellent. Who needed all that extra baggage? We brought home our purchases and proceeded to examine each object as if it were a meteor that had landed in our living room. A mesh bag for laundry, stackable tin plates that converted to frying pans, an aluminum canteen with a built-in cup. These purchases, coupled with the picture of the smiling girl riding a horse on the camp brochure, left little doubt in my mind that Pine Lodge Mountain Summer Camp meant nonstop fun and adventure. The only doubt lingering in my mind concerned the sleeping bag. Despite my father's reassurance, there existed no bag in our house big enough to hold this monstrosity. No matter how much my brother, father, and I sat on the sleeping bag, we could not make it less bulky. It defied flattening. The synthetic material used to stuff my sleeping bag would have been much better utilized in some other place, like freeway dividers. But for now, I was stuck with the King Kong of all sleeping bags and nothing to put it in. Finally, my father, with his mind of an engineer, came up with a brilliant solution, a hefty trash bag. A few months later, my father and I drove to the bus stop together. Like any other child going to overnight camp for the first time, I immediately regretted my decision. My father did his best to calm me by telling me stories of his first year in America as a Fulbright scholar at Texas A&M. He spoke fondly of his Pakistani roommate who made delicious curry, but whose name he no longer remembered. My father's stories made one fact abundantly clear. I did not want to go to camp. We arrived at the bus stop only to discover that all the other kids had signed up with at least one friend. My family had just moved from Whittier to Newport Beach, so I didn't have a friend anywhere, especially at this bus stop. To make matters worse, everyone was staring at my hefty trash bag. We finally boarded the bus. I sat by myself and secretly wished that some kind person would sit next to me and be my friend. No one sat next to me. As the bus ride began, I was acutely aware of how much fun all the kids around me seemed to be having. Giggles and laughter filled the bus. After a few hours on the road, the boy behind me tapped me on the shoulder. "Hey, can I ask you a question?" he said. "Sure," I answered. "Well," he said, "do you look down a lot?"
"No, why?" I asked.
"Well, your nose points downward, so I figured that's because you're always looking at the ground or something."
Upon hearing this, all the kids around me burst out laughing. Hours later, we arrived at camp. Pine Lodge was a converted two-story house. All the boys stayed downstairs, and all the girls stayed on the second floor. In the girls' room stood rows of bunk beds. There was one bathroom on the floor for all the girls to share. Oddly, the door to the bathroom had been removed, so any girl who needed to use the toilet or the sink could walk in on someone taking a shower. Coming from a modest culture and an even more modest family, I had never seen another person naked, not even my mother. So the idea that someone could walk into the bathroom while I was naked in the shower seemed unbelievable. I decided then and there not to bathe. Out of the 11 other girls in my room, 10 appeared to be mean. Mary, who slept on the top of my bunk, was the only girl who would speak to me, or rather cry to me. I liked her right away, not as a friend, but as someone who made me look good. Mary and her younger brother, Willie, were both campers, and they spent all day trying to be on the same team for all activities and all night crying at the idea of being separated. I had never known a brother and sister who actually enjoyed each other's company so much. I soon discovered it wasn't that they enjoyed each other's company so much as they were simply afraid of everybody else. The two of them managed to be the butt of every joke. Mary felt responsible for Willie, whose Coke bottle glasses and tendency to tremble made him an easy target for all the boys. Mary herself was not much more resilient. All someone had to do to reduce her to tears was to call her a name, any name. Mary and Willie were a huge source of comfort to me, not only because they hated Pine Lodge Mountain Summer Camp as much as I did, but because they were the ones whom everyone picked on. I knew that in the pecking order of favorite targets for mean kids, I followed Mary and her brother. But those two, between their crying, their trembling, and their throwing up when nervous, proved far more satisfying targets than I could have ever hoped to be. In fact, not only did I not get picked on, but I was completely ignored by everyone, including the counselors. Had it not been for Mary sobbing to me every night, I could have sworn I was at a Zen retreat. Since I wasn't going to bathe, I decided to minimize getting dirty by participating only in arts and crafts. I skipped the horseback riding, the overnight camp out, the archery lessons, the hikes to the Indian grounds, and basically every activity outlined in the camp brochure. Every morning, I showed up at the macrame station ready to make another keychain. At the end of the first week, the counselors announced that the camp would be putting on a play called Fiddler on the Roof, and everyone would have to participate. Each camper was assigned a role. I was to play the ghost of the grandmother. Even though I had only one line, the role required that I be covered head to toe with talcum powder. I now suspect that this was a ploy to encourage me to bathe. The night of the play, one of the counselors started to apply the talcum powder, but soon ran into a problem. A week's worth of oil had accumulated on my hair and body, and the talcum powder clumped the instant it touched me. Rather than look like a ghost, I resembled someone who'd been dunked in a vat of bread dough. After the play, I really wanted to bathe, but I simply could not. The idea of any of the mean girls walking in on me as I took a shower was just too much. Plus, I had achieved such a near-invisible status, I didn't think anyone would notice how dirty I was. Nobody, except for the macrame teacher Pat, ever talked to me, so I had no motivation to risk humiliation in exchange for hygiene. Finally, the last day of camp arrived. I put on the one clean t-shirt I had saved for this day, packed my 12 keychains, rolled the sleeping bag into its trash bag, and waited for the bus. I didn't have to worry about any emotional goodbyes, since this was by far my happiest day at camp. I exchanged addresses only with Pat. I didn't have much to say to Mary, since our relationship was based entirely on her sobbing and my listening. I wondered whether her father would be angry if he'd learned he had spent $1,000 on camp for his kids, and they had done nothing but cry. I, at least, had my keychains, and by the second week, even Pat had remarked on the quality of my knots. I arrived at the bus station to find my father and oldest brother Farid waiting for me. Upon seeing me, Farid screamed, "You stink! Didn't you bathe at all?" All of a sudden, I realized the gravity of the situation. I had not washed my body in 2 weeks. Having lost my near-invisible camp status, I was overcome with embarrassment and shame. "Of course I bathed," I replied. During the car ride back, my father asked me if I had enjoyed camp. "It was great," I said. I knew he had sent me to camp, expecting $500 worth of fun, and I didn't have the heart to tell him the truth. So instead of weaving keychains, I spent the next few weeks weaving stories of all my great adventures. I don't know whether my father believed me, but at least I earned the reputation as the best keychain maker in the family. You can call me Al. My father's favorite spot on planet Earth is Las Vegas. As a child, I had to endure endless vacations to that den o' sin in the desert. Whenever a 3 or 4 day weekend rolled around, my father would happily announce, "We're going to Las Vegas." I hated it. But Las Vegas was cheap, and so was my father, so off we went. Las Vegas was a 4-hour drive from our house. The highway leading to this promised land cut through the desert, which meant that watching the scenery from the back seat of our Chevrolet rivaled the thrill of watching a fishing show. My brothers, both of them in college, were spared these trips. I envied them. The ritual was always the same. We would have to wake up by 5 a.m. so we could be on the road by 5:15. The day before our trip, the gas tank was filled, the engine checked, the suitcases packed, and the windshield cleaned, all courtesy of my father. The most important part of our ritual involved my mother's holding the Quran at the top of the door frame while we each walked under it. For my parents, this ensured a safe journey. They hoped one without speeding tickets. I always found it unsettling to invoke religion in anything having to do with Las Vegas, a place that I'm quite sure the Prophet Muhammad would not have approved of. We always drove for 1 hour before stopping for breakfast at Denny's. My father's devotion to Denny's restaurants approached religious fervor. To him, Denny's was a clean oasis where the waitresses were always friendly. We didn't really like the food, but that seemed like a small price to pay for a clean bathroom in the middle of the desert. After breakfast, we'd get back in the car, turn on the air conditioner, and keep driving. We didn't stop until the next Denny's, where we'd have a snack, and my father would say how amazing it was that all Denny's could be so clean no matter where.